I wanted to go back to the book of Romans today, so I want to take some time and pick up where we left off, do a little bit of a recap here in chapter 13, where we left off. I was looking back on our record of where we had left off in the coverage of this book and found that, surprisingly, we only got through 7 verses of chapter 13, but those 7 verses were certainly jam-packed with a lot of information, of which in this particular case, I'd like to recap just a little bit of it. Now, as we go through this book, and we're now 2 years into this book, believe it or not. We started this book in December of 2015. And as I mentioned, I was going to salt and pepper it through other sermons and so on, but I didn't think it would extend throughout almost a 2-year period here. So hopefully we can finish it as we come up on the finish line of 2016. But at any rate, I wanted to bring your attention back to Romans chapter 12 just to kind of give you a little bit of the flow of what we had covered there. Now, there was a lot of specific ideas with regards to behavioral patterns, suggestions, and concepts that the apostle wanted those Christians in Rome to grasp, and of which were focused around how to behave in terms of love and care and concern. And you go down through, especially as it launches into the details starting around verse 9 through the end of the chapter, verses 21 there, you see a lot of advice with regards to what is defined as Christian love, what is defined as Christian behavior and value of behavior, and of course, advice in those areas that would certainly have followed, help all of us to be more compatible with our fellow man. In verse 19 of chapter 12, you see, "Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place to anger, for it's written, vengeance is mine." So let things be, if you can, as much as possible, because God will take care of things in the long run. It will work out as He sees fit and deems necessary. And he ends the chapter, verse 21, with, "Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good," and then launches into what appears to be, and in most cases many will recognize as, a political overture to become aware of your relationship with government, of your relationship with the state, with the secular rule that you live in. It's almost as though this is what is called an interpolation or pollation, an insert of sort, like a digression or thought that came up all of a sudden out of the blue, and he addresses it, because if you take, as I mentioned before, verse 21 and jump to verse 8 of Romans 13, you'll see that there is a continuity there. But it almost seems verses 1 through 7 of chapter 13 are kind of like an insert that is almost on a different subject. However, when you really look at it, when you really analyze it, you begin to see that what Paul is talking about is one should have a certain affinity for the government that is over you, and that you and I as Christians are requested on behalf of Paul's appeal representing God to conform to those rules, regulations of the state. In other words, what he's saying is you should be a model citizen regardless, whether you're in communistic nations, whether you're in socialistic nations, whether you're in a democracy. As long as that government doesn't cause you to compromise your values. You can read this down through one. I'm not going to belabor it because we've already covered this. If you want to get back to the details of it, go back and listen to the disc before this one where we covered part one in Romans 13. But the reality of it is, brethren, there are some very interesting points here that merit and are worth repeating, and that is that we need, as Christians, to be model citizens as long as the government does not require us to violate God's laws. Once it steps into that area, now we've got a problem. However, it's not the problem of taking up arms, as Paul tries to articulate, but it is the problem of you conceding to the consequences of your faith. And that's a big and tall order. Because at some point, if indeed that comes to fruition, where you've got to stand up and make a statement for your faith and that you're in conflict with the state, well then guess what? the state has the sword, figuratively speaking, if you know what I'm saying. They have the power over you to confiscate property, to put you in jail, to do whatever, you know, they want to do with you. And the history of God's church, guess what it shows? That's what happened. That's what happened. A lot of those early New Testament Christians, even down through the Middle Ages, over there in the Piedmont valleys of France, and so many who were those early Sabbath holy day keepers and who refused to submit to the Catholic Church, the Jesuit rule, and so on, had to put up with a lot of abuses because they would not submit to the leadership and rulership of the Catholic Church and those very Catholic countries at that time in the history of humankind. So, in some respects, it's a fine line. As Christians, we actually carry dual citizenship. We're ambassadors of another government in a foreign land, planet Earth, representing that foreign government, as ambassadors would do. You know, ambassador leaves his home country, goes to a foreign land and represents that home country in whatever country he's assigned to. George Ramakan is in England right now. He's living in London. George Ramakan as a diplomat representing as, not an ambassador, but you might as well say he's in an ambassadorship because he basically is representing the Jamaican government from afar in England as a servant representative of Jamaica in England, in London. And that's what ambassadorships are. So we, in that respect, are similar in that kind of relationship that we have. And so it is very important that we do the best we can to be good stewards. And that's why Paul kind of consolidates and concludes his comments here in verse 5 where he says, "Wherefore you must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For this cause, pay your taxes." That's what he's saying, essentially. And this was the government of Rome. This was the government of Rome. And Nero was the emperor. Now, admittedly, this was before Nero went off the rails. But the point is well taken that Paul is essentially encouraging those Christians to take care of the duty that is due the government because they are there for your welfare at the end of the day. Except if they cause you to violate your faith, now you're in a different area. Let me again reiterate that qualification. But in general, they're the ones with the army. They're the ones that are there for your liberty and freedom, protection and provision. And so in all due respect, there is a certain element of responsibility we as Christians have to be non-troublemakers. Now, that's not to say you can't express your dissatisfaction. That's not to say that you cannot express to your representatives things that you're not satisfied with. And here in the United States, we have that privilege, and it is a great privilege that oftentimes certainly merits the exercising of that freedom of speech. But my point is, and what Paul is trying to say here, is that in all due respect, they deserve to be paid so that those that serve can be also paid. For they are God's ministers, verse 6 now, attending continually upon this very thing. Therefore render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, and honor to whom honor. In other words, if you go to see the President of the United States, if you go to see the Prime Minister of London, don't go there in cutoffs, no socks, and you know, tennis shoes, and walk up and say, "Hey man, how you doing, bud?" You know, that kind of a thing. You pay honor where honor is due. And you come before a royalty, you come before someone of authority that represents an office that should be respected, then you should respect, even if you don't respect the person, guess what? Respect the office. Respect the office. And that's what Paul's talking about in so many words. But then he goes back to verse 8, and here we pick up now. Owe no man, and he comes right back to this love thing. He comes back to bookending. He ended up there in verse 21 of Romans 12 talking about love. That all those specifics from verses 9 in chapter 12 through about 21 were very site-specific on particular characteristics, particular behavioral attributes that he wanted those Christians in Rome to get associated with, to recognize, to inculcate into their personalities. And also, and it, I would certainly believe that it's a fair statement to say, to be extrapolated and overlaid on and toward your relationship with the government. That is a little liberty I'm taking there, suffice it to say. But nevertheless, in the context of the bookend here, of verses 21 to verse 8 of chapter 13, you've got this government narrative kind of sandwiched in this two-pronged element discussion or narrative about love and about affection and certain behavioral attributes that are are leaning toward the tendency of being obedient and conceding to these affections. So in verse 8, he says, look, owe no man anything. And that Greek word that is translated here in the King James, owe, some other translations translated as debt. Do not be indebted to anybody. Pay back your debts. If I borrow the grass cutter from you, make sure I return it in as good, if not better, condition than when I borrowed it from you. That's the principle. If I borrow 10 bucks from you, you know what? Even though you're not going to charge me interest, maybe I give you 11 back. My point is, you give back immediately or as fast as you can. Be indebted. Owe nobody anything for any length of time. And that's a good principle to adhere to, even in other aspects of our life, whether they be debts on our house, debts in our credit cards, and what have you. But he goes on here and he says, owe no man anything, but, this is what you should owe him, to love one another. For he that loves another has fulfilled the law. And this also bears some time here to park a little bit. I want to turn your attention over here to Galatians chapter 5. Galatians, the book of Galatians, and in chapter 5, and in verse 14. And I break into the context for the sake of time. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even in this, and that is, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And that, in another portion, I'll just reference it, in James chapter 2, and in verse 8, Jesus' half-brother, James, identifies that very law, this law of loving your brother as yourself. He calls it the royal law. It's the royal law. It is the come see, come saw relationship of reciprocation, the ultimate in expression of reciprocation. If I care for you as much as, you know, I care for you as much as I care for myself, then most likely you will avoid mistreating others. And that's the whole point. If you care about somebody as much as you care about yourself, you've got a good opportunity and a very high percentage of avoiding mistreating other people. Assuming, of course, you hold yourself in respect. There are people that suffer from low self-esteem as well, but again, there's always anomalies in every situation. But the point is well taken here with what the apostle is attempting to try and express. Now, in the next book of Ephesians, chapter 5, over here in chapter 5, notice this. And this is some additional instruction that expands on what he mentions over there in chapter 13 of verse 8 in Romans, where he says, for he that loves another has fulfilled the law. Here in chapter 5, the book of Ephesians now, verse 1, be you therefore followers of God as dear children, and walk in love, agape, walk in affection, walk with feelings toward others. Understand that everybody has problems. Everybody puts their pants on one leg at a time, unless they're sitting down. But the point of it is, everybody has issues. We're all in this together. One thing that we all have in common, we're all subject to the same bondage, the bondage of death. That should implore compassion for each of us as we share time and space with each other on each other's journey through life. We see each other fall time to time through life's experiences, whether it's due to circumstances that are not controllable by ourselves or by them, or even health issues where there's no control. Sometimes we're just victimized by certain things that surround us. We should all be of that compassionate mode to where we're sensitive and we have feelings for each other. He says in verse 5 here, verse 1 of chapter 5, book of Ephesians, Paul, same writer, but and essentially the same message, but now to this church in Ephesus, "Be you therefore followers of God as dear children, and walk in love as Christ also loved us, and has given himself for us as an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling savor." So we should be willing to sacrifice for one another, go out of our way for each other, even when it's not convenient for ourselves. And Paul, you're going to see here in a moment in chapter 13 of the book of Romans, when we go back to it, as he proceeds down through this expansion of and discussion and narrative of love, what he's talking about exactly. He's going to get into that again and go back to giving us some advice as he did in Romans 12. But suffice it to say, let me stay here in chapter 5 of the book of Ephesians. He goes on here and he gives us some advice here. He says, fornication, uncleanness and covetousness, let it not be named among you as becomes saints. Neither filthiness nor foolish talking nor jesting, which are not convenient, but rather giving of thanks. Yesterday is the epitome of one's life mode. That's right. Yesterday, Thanksgiving, is the epitome of living one's life. Being thankful, grateful for God, family, country. Taking time out to appreciate all of the blessings that you have in all the things that are part of your life, part of your journey through this dimension of time and space that we share together. He says here, but rather giving of thanks, verse 5 now, chapter 5, book of Ephesians, "For this you know, no whoremonger, unclean person, covetous man, who is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. Let no man deceive you with vain works. For because of these things," because of the things he just articulated and enumerated, "it's because of these things comes God's anger upon the children of disobedience. Be not therefore partakers with them," verse 8, "for you were sometimes darkness, but now you're in light in the Lord. Walk as children of light." So you were like that. Now that you're children of light, be that way now. Paul said, remember in Romans chapter 8, that those who aspire to those things of the flesh will ultimately die. We should be, if we are in the Spirit, be as though we are already Spirit beings. That's what he says there in Romans chapter 8. Go back and review that disc when you get a chance and review some of the content we covered in that. He was actually appealing to all of us that if indeed we are begotten of God's Spirit, we should already be acting as though we're Spirit beings in the kingdom of God, doing the best we can, kicking against, as they say, the pricks, and trying to do the best we can to maintain this model citizenship exemplification that we are mandated to do on behalf of Jesus Christ. He goes on here. He says in verse 9, "For the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness and righteousness and truth, proving what is acceptable unto the Lord." You can continue to read down through verse 21, from 11 through 21. I won't spend the time doing that, but he continues on talking again about specific behaviors and specific adjustments in the expression of certain characteristics that we should all be party to and have as part of our expression in the exemplification of Christ in us. So now back to chapter 13. He says here this thing about love one another has, and that being the fulfillment of the law. And this is what he's talking about in verse 9. Now he goes into some detail. And what does he do? He enumerates some of the Ten Commandments. He goes right to some of the Ten Commandments. And remember, the Ten Commandments were known as the Ten Words. In Hebrew, in the Hebrew and the Torah and in that culture, it's known as the Ten Words, the Ten Commandments. And in this particular case, he goes on and he says, "You shall not commit adultery." Don't betray one another in that fashion. That's betrayal. That's what that's all about. Betrayal. Do not do that. You shall not murder. It's not about killing. Killing can be acceptable. But it's murder that the law is against. Murder. The debate of self-defense, the debate of when it justifies for the fact of defending property or family, certainly is a logical debate and oftentimes merits discussion. But the fact of it is, the commandment, don't dismiss this, the commandment is very specific. You shall not commit murder. That's what it's all about. He says here in this case, you shall not steal. Don't take something from somebody without asking them first and getting their permission. I try to teach all my grandchildren that all the time, even my own daughters as they were growing up, in the definition of stealing. What's the definition of stealing? When you take something that you didn't ask for first. You need to ask always if it belongs to somebody, if it belongs to a store, if it belongs to a person, if it belongs to, you know, a friend of yours. You always, if you want it or you want to use it, you ask before taking all the time. Get permission, because they deserve the sovereignty and the right to deny you. they really do, and you need to give them that prerogative since they own whatever you're asking for. You shall not bear false witness. And this goes to the fact of lying, of course. But it also goes one step further when you dig into this, and that is on the purpose of treachery, where you are actually attempting to lie on behalf of someone else in conspiracy to get this person convicted against or for something that they don't deserve to be convicted. It actually goes deeper than just lying. It goes into treachery and conspiracy and working together as a team to attempt to try to get somebody convicted who was innocent, similar to what happened to Jesus Christ. That's a perfect example. The kangaroo court that the high priest pulled together to attempt to bring forth all these false witnesses to bear a case and build a case against Christ, of which really did have no merit, but nevertheless, they proceeded to, of course, convict him on. You shall not covet. Don't lust after things that are not yours or that are beyond your reach. You end up getting in trouble doing those kinds of things, or you'll end up getting in trouble if you do those kinds of things. And if there be any other commandment, you see where he's going with this? How do people say the commandments are not in effect? I mean, they are. He just summarized it. Yeah, he didn't list the Sabbath. Of course, he didn't list, you know, love God first with all your might. He didn't list don't take God's name in vain. But it's clear here, by virtue of what he's saying, and certainly through the association of examples that he's using, that he's talking about the Ten Commandments here, and then goes and says in a summation statement, if there be any other commandment, it is briefly comprehended in this saying, namely, and then he summarizes it all. You shall love your neighbor, he says here, as yourself. Love works no ill to his neighbor. Therefore, love, again, and he reiterates what he just said in verse 8, almost as a redundancy, trying to hammer this point home. You have to understand, and remember too, he was talking to Gentiles primarily in the city of Rome. So a lot of this was foreign to their thinking in many respects, as opposed to the Hebrew culture who grew up with the Torah. So yes, there were Jews in the audience. There were Jews in the audience who were very familiar with what he was referencing as principles of association and of certain advice and how to balance your life and live your life accordingly. Yet the fact of it is, a lot were not. And so he was taking the opportunity through reiteration and redundancy to drive these points home. And again, he says in verse 10, love works no ill to his neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. Now, again, I want to park here for a moment and reference Matthew chapter 22. Go back to Matthew chapter 22 for a moment. Here Jesus goes back to the foundation of what his ministry really was all about. I'm going to break into the context here in verse 34, chapter 22, book of Matthew. But when the Pharisees heard that he had put the Sadducees to silence, they were gathered together, and one of them, which was a lawyer, asks him a question and tempts him. So the guy's got an attitude, and Jesus perceived it immediately. And he says, Master, verse 36 now, Matthew 22, which is the great commandment in the law? And Jesus proceeds to quote Deuteronomy. A lot of people claim, well, these are New Testament statements. These are not New Testament statements. These are Old Testament statements. Jesus was going right back over there in Deuteronomy. And if you'll notice, go back to Deuteronomy chapter 6. Keep your fingers in Matthew 22. Go to Deuteronomy 26 for a moment. Or Deuteronomy 6, I'm sorry. Deuteronomy 6. Deuteronomy 6, you will see here the very statement that Jesus basically is referencing. And in verse 5, he says, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. He went back and reached right there. Jesus knew the law. He's speaking from the Torah. It's the only scriptures available at the time. Again, let me remind all of us. And in chapter 22 of the book of Matthew, going back in verse 37, Jesus says, and he quotes, you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your mind. He knew it by heart. He knew it by heart. He moves on, verse 38, chapter 22. This is the first and great commandment. And that summarizes, I'm sure many of you have often heard this, the first four commandments, which portend, they connect up with the love of God. The love of God. He goes on here and he says, 39, the second is like unto it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. This is what Paul's been talking about. This is what Paul was referencing. But actually what Paul was not only referencing, but through the connection of Christ, here Christ is saying the same thing Paul's saying, but you know what Christ is quoting? He's quoting Leviticus 19. Go back to Leviticus for a moment. Chapter 19 and in verse 18, I think it is. Leviticus 19. Keep your finger in Matthew 22. We're going to go back there. 19 and in verse 18. You shall not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There it is, right there. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. And so when people say the Ten Commandments, and I just say this in passing, are not applicable today because Jesus laid down these two commandments, that's almost an oxymoron. I mean, because in the context of what Jesus is talking about here, he's talking about the Ten Commandments. But in so few words, is summarizing them. Because to the point of this second one, takes into account the latter six. So you've got all ten covered. The first four are covered in the first commandment that he says, love God with all your heart and mind. And the second one is covered here, the other six, the latter six, in your relationship to mankind. Don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't kill, don't, you know, all the things of, that are associated with your relationship with man. Verse 40 then, he states it all. And he makes it very clear. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. So now he pins it right to the law. Without a doubt, he actually pins these two statements he just made in summation to the Torah and prophets. So how can you say these eliminate the Ten Commandments? It's almost absurd and a bit ridiculous to go that far to say such a thing, especially in verse 40 when he concludes what he does when he states it that, you know, on the law and the prophets, these two statements hang. But back to Romans chapter 13 now. Back to Romans chapter 13. And in verse 10, where we were, he says, love is the fulfilling of the law, and that knowing the time that now is high time to awake out of sleep, For now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. And what he's saying here is, look, love is incumbent on all of us to get busy about expressing, to get busy about feeling, to get busy about developing in our lives. Time is of the essence. Now, in this case, the many scholars will tell you that because Paul thought Jesus was going to return in his lifetime, he was trying to put a sense of urgency on a lot of the people in hopes that it would spur them on, motivate them to get busy in their lives and continue to understand the love of God and how it plays a very major part in their lives. And it does play a very major part in our lives. As mentioned there in Matthew, just let me interrupt myself over here and take you back to John chapter 13 for a moment. John chapter 13, again, the emphasis on love in the ministry of Jesus Christ. And as Paul continued to try to advance, he says here in John chapter 13, verse 34, Jesus states, "A new commandment I'm giving to you, that you love one another. As I loved you, that you also love one another." And Jesus loved us in a very sacrificial way, the operative being sacrificial. He was willing to put himself out, even though it wasn't convenient. He was willing to give up his time, his life, for us so that he might serve you and me. That's selflessness. And part of this whole idea of selflessness, of which Paul is attempting to explain in chapter 13, is dealing with the Ten Commandments surrounding a lot of their indication of how we should behave and be. In chapter 14, book of John, just a page over, and in verse 15 he says, "If you love me, if you love me, if you love Christ, keep his commandments." And of course, all of us are well aware that the love of God is described and defined in 1 John chapter 5 and in verse 3, where it states the love of God is to keep his commandments. So love plays a big part in the summation of the overall gospel message as it pertains to salvation. From Genesis to Revelation, brethren, love plays a big part in expression between God and man, man to God, and man to man. Very important. And it is salt and pepper throughout the Scriptures to afford us, hopefully, the insight of the responsibilities that we have in loving God and in loving our fellow man. So in verse 11, I reiterate and come back to this, what you could say, line in the sand, because at this point, he completes this generalization of appeal for love in one's life, and now attempts to try to motivate by essentially saying, look, the time is upon us. Time is short. Yes, many scholars claim, as I've already said, that because he felt Jesus was going to return in his time, the night, verse 12, is far spent. The day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness. Let us put on the armor of light. And so this appeal to be motivated, to get busy about inculcating love in your life, is important. It merits our consideration. It goes without argument, without debate, that yes, love is what the world needs. If we had more people, as I've already mentioned, caring for others as much as they care for themselves, we would have a lot less violence in the world, and a lot less killing. But the fact of it is, Paul goes on and he says, let us walk honestly. And he gives a bit of advice here. As in the day, not in rioting, drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envying, but put you on the Lord Jesus Christ, make not provisions for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof. And the other element of this motivational segment of verses 11 through 14, I want to just lay out here for all of us as well. Because we know that Paul missed the mark as far as assuming when Jesus was going to return, because he didn't come in his lifetime. So he kind of missed that mark by, looks like now, some 2,000 years. But that doesn't erase the fact, does not erase the fact that we are up against time. And so however old we are, and as I've often referenced my old sermon from many years back when I likened the 7 weeks between the Sabbath during the days of unleavened bread and Pentecost being representative of the 70 decades of one's life, 70 years. The fact of it is, some of us, depending on how old we are, 40, 45, we're 4.0 weeks into our life. We're 4.5 weeks into our life. We're 5.6 weeks into our life. However it may be, if we're 56, if we're 77, 7.7, well, then, like I've often said, we're ahead of the game. More power to you. I hope you have another 10 and you make 8.7, you know. But the reality of it is, and here's my point, that we are up against time. And you see, the day is far spent. I couldn't believe, as we were sitting around the Thanksgiving table just a few days ago, that some of those that were there I hadn't seen for quite a long time in this situation, namely a year ago, in the same situation. I saw them in between, of course, the two Thanksgivings, but Thanksgiving to Thanksgiving, it was hard to believe another year has gone by. And there we are sitting in the same chairs, in the same room, eating similar foods because we have our traditions. But my point being is that there we were, and I look back and I said, wow, where did the year go? And here we are now, winter time. Where did the year go? I just remember putting my new calendar up on the wall and starting. And lo and behold, boom, boom, boom. And here, now we're 11 months into this year, heading toward the end of the year, according to Pope Gregory. And as a result, just in case you didn't know who he was, next thing you know, we're going to be in 2017. And God willing, I hope, if I behave myself, I'll be sitting at that Thanksgiving table again. A year later saying, wow, where did the year go again, you know. But here's the point of all of this. We're against time. And time is passing us by. Each day, we're a little bit closer to hitting the dirt, figuratively speaking, but literally as well. And so it is important, as Paul says here in verse 11. And let me add this to that perspective. Knowing time, that now is high time to awake out of sleep. For now is our salvation nearer than when we believe. Because once you're in the grave, brethren, your legacy is done. The book you've written is finished. The chapters are concluded. There's no more sentences to add. No more paragraphs. No more chapters. Who you are, what you are, is what it is. And when you're in your coffin, dead, no knowledge, no works, no praise of God, who and what you are is what it is. Therefore, to Paul's point, it is so important to learn to love God. And how do you learn to love God? Let me take you back here. In the context of the Apostle Paul, to Exodus chapter 20. You shall have no other gods before me. Verse 3. You shall not make any graven images or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down yourself nor serve them, for I am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations, showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Idolatry, we need to flee. We need to eschew. Don't allow any images to come between you and God. And in this modern day and age, you can extrapolate the things that distract us from God. You can extrapolate the idolatrous ways of life and pursuits that people become distracted in that make gods to them and oftentimes prevent them from seeing a true relationship with God because they're wrapped up with fame, fortune, places to go, people to meet, things to do. Never time to sit and understand the finer things of life, the more long-lasting things of life, because everything in this world, brethren, is timed. It's going to vanquish. It's going to disappear, and it's going to, for all intents and purposes, end. So, you don't have any other gods before our God. You don't make any images or allow anything to come between you and God. You don't take His name in vain. Verse 7, you shall not take the name of the Lord in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that takes His name in vain. Be careful on how you spread the name of God and when you use it and bring it into your conversation. Understand that unless it is for edification purposes and it has some overall riding value and purpose to the discussion and conversation, I would be very thoughtful, prudent, cautious on how you use the name of Yahweh, Yahshua, Jesus the Christ. It doesn't come lightly. We need to respect these names of those that are in charge of the universe and who have given so much together as a team for the salvation of humankind. Number 8, as though he knew we would forget. Remember the Sabbath day. Every Sabbath morning, brethren, if you've got the courage to do it, when you wake up, ask yourself what you're going to do, because you're in holy time. Like it or not, every time that sun sets on Friday night, you have entered into holy time, and God's watching. What are you doing with His holy time? When the holy days come around, the sun sets, and the days of unleavened bread commence, or Pentecost commences, or trumpets commences, the day of atonement commences, tabernacles, last day. Where are you? If you have the courage, ask yourself, why am I at this bar on the Sabbath? You know, why am I doing what I'm doing? I'm somewhere else that I shouldn't be on the Sabbath day. What am I doing? Why am I home? What is it that kept me home today from the Sabbath? Because it says, don't forsake the assembly of yourselves. I mean, that's scriptural, Hebrews. Don't forsake the assembly of yourselves. Even more so as you see the day approaching. And yet today, cavalier approach toward Sabbath keeping, cavalier approach toward holy day keeping. I don't feel like it. I'm too tired. What if Jesus was too tired to do what he did? Father, I'm too tired. I don't want to be bothered today with this. But can we put it off another year? I mean, these are the things, brethren, you need to be courageous about asking yourselves when you know yourselves are drifting or whatever you're doing or putting something in front of, because that's the point. Because if there's something, and the Sabbath day is a test commandment. The holy days are test commandments. You know, people say that the dietary laws are not spiritual. I'm in the process of editing something for the CGI, for our systematic theology project. And there's a debate out there that the dietary laws are not spiritual. They're purely health related. You don't eat pork because you can get trichinosis. You don't eat shellfish because they're hard to digest. They might give you indigestion. You know, you might OD, like if you ate pork on high protein, because that's like putting jet fuel into a Volkswagen, you know, they say. And there's a lot of research, you know, that goes on with pork meat and shellfish and all the things that oftentimes it's very good when you get the scientific facts that, you know what, from a health standpoint, they aren't good for me. It's not good. Maybe I shouldn't eat it just for the sake of health. But there is a spiritual tie-in to these dietary laws. Just like there's a spiritual tie-in to leaven and unleavened bread during the days of leaven and unleavened bread. Just because you eat unleavened bread, does that make it something healthy for you or physical only? No, there's a spiritual association with that. When you eat unleavened bread, there's a lot of things we don't, I'm not going to belabor the point of it, but you also come in contact with, throughout the course of that week, donuts, I'm sure, cinnamon buns, nice bread, 12-grain bread, all kinds of things during that week. You even go shopping and there it is on the shelf. And maybe you covet. Ooh. maybe you cheat and then don't tell the truth because you tell everybody, oh no, I didn't mess up this week. I was okay. Did you ever think that the dietary laws are just nothing more than a 365-day expression of the days of unleavened bread, but with clean and unclean meats? Oh, that is something. No, they're spiritual. Those dietary laws, don't you kid yourself, are very spiritual. You like lobster, surf and turf? You willing to pass it up and let it go? You like those old pork chops with mashed potatoes and applesauce, like I did when I was 5 years old, 6 years old? That was one of my favorite meals, pork chops, applesauce, and mashed potatoes. I could eat that all my life. You willing to give that up? You willing to give up shellfish, clam chowder, whatever else, kohlrabi? is that what it is? Kalahari. What's kohlrabi? Calamari. Calamari. What's kohlrabi? Is that a capital city in the Middle East somewhere? But you know what I mean. There's a lot of people that find it very difficult to do these kinds of things. And that is a spiritual exercise to let that lobster go. It's a spiritual exercise to let that pig go. No more bacon. A lot of people like bacon. BLTs. Bacon and eggs. Bacon bits on the salads. And I didn't mind it. I'm sure some of you didn't mind it when you ate it. Now, when I see it, matter of fact, when I see it on my salad accidentally, and it just happened here recently, I got a Caesar salad, and there were bacon bits on the Caesar salad, and I thought, I'm just going to eat it. And I thought, no, I'm in a battle here. Now, you may find that silly, but the fact of it is, I made an issue out of it. I told him to take it back, give me another one. And why? Because it was physical? No, I just felt like I was in a spiritual battle there. Silly as that may be. These dietary laws, brethren, as much as the days of unleavened bread are, spiritual in their value, spiritual in their association. And oftentimes, I think we minimize and become very cavalier and casual about things that really we shouldn't. We should rethink some of these things because they are good. They are good considerations for managing your life. And so it is here in verse 11 through 14 of Romans chapter 13 that it's high time we do these things, that we get these principles, these laws into our lives and really establish and inculcate them into our personalities. I could continue on in chapter 20 of the book of Exodus with the latter six. I won't do that. I'll leave that for you. But those laws pertain to your relationship with your fellow man. You know that as well as I do. We don't need to belabor it. And the reality of it is we need to take these actions and activities that we involve ourselves with when we exercise discipline not to lie, whether it's in business or in relationships, not to covet, not to, take a friend's wife or husband. These are things that we need to recognize are not good, nor do they promote peace and well-being amongst ourselves. We need to respect each other's boundaries, and we need to respect each other's sovereign right to the things that they involve themselves with. So the apostle does really appeal for all of us to not take this cavalier approach. Don't put off what you can do today till tomorrow. Watch out for procrastination. Don't say, I'll get around to it. You ever see those little round to it? People give them out, a little round to it. You don't want that kind of thing. You want to do it immediately, and you want to get busy and be motivated and be consistent in your involvement with developing these things as part and parcel to your life.